right, as the clerk announced, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals, and we're going to go a little bit out of order today in the hopes that our other attorney will arrive on the next case. So we will begin this morning the first case, 2-15-134-CR. That has been postponed until the early part of January at the party's request. Hoskins and Eckel, we will hear in just a little bit. And then we'll proceed with Stevens versus State, which relates to cause number 2-15-046-CR and 047-CR. I understand everybody has already checked in with our clerks, and I believe we have Mr. J. Edward, is it Niehaus? Okay, and that you've turned in a request for the 15-minute and 5-minute rebuttal. And then we have Andrea Simmons from the District Attorney's Office who has requested her 15 minutes. And I believe you all are ready to proceed. So, Mr. Niehaus.
Please the court. Chief Justice Livingston, Justice Gabriel and Meyer, and J. Edward Niehaus here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Brent Stevens. Apologize, I'm a bit under the weather, getting over the flu. We're here on Mr. Stevens' conviction on 4 counts of indecency with a child. I've alleged 4 points of error in my brief. I intend to argue predominantly the first two. Error in admission of the forensic interview, which is an error this court has addressed before. And then Marin typing, the court's failure to hold an Article 3837, Section 2A hearing. I will touch briefly on the third issue, the trial court's refusal to allow appellant to present his defensive theory of conspiracy, specifically as it relates to the error in admitting the forensic interview. My fourth issue, error in stacking the sentences, as the court knows, is dispositively decided against me by Court of Criminal Appeals precedent, so I will not argue that before this court at this time. First, the trial court erred in admitting the forensic interview. There's Court of Criminal Appeals case law specifically on point, Bays versus State, 2013. Says that it is an abuse of discretion to admit the forensic interview. In this case, the court admitted the forensic interview over a timely, contemporaneous, and specific objection by defense counsel. The interview is admitted on the state's reliance on Hammonds v. State, essentially that the defense counsel's, won't go so far as to call it discrediting the witness, because I don't think the cross-examination actually rose to that level. But the calling into question the credibility of the witness opened the door to the admission of the forensic interview. With respect to the trial court, Hammonds does not go that far. Specifically, Hammonds gets into the admission of a similar statement under 801E1B. Non-hearsay statements offered to rebut charge of recent fabrication. Application of Hammonds in this case fails to appreciate when the allegation of fabrication occurred. In this case, the allegation of fabrication predates the forensic interview. Appellant's position is that the charges against him from outcry to forensic interview to trial have been fabricated the entire time, and that the there can't be a prior consistent statement that rebuts a charge of recent fabrication where the fabrication predates that statement.
Well, certainly the cross-examination at least raised an arguably raised a question as to perhaps this phrase that was used being suggested by someone at the Children's Advocacy Center, doesn't it? So that wouldn't be something that was prior to, I mean, that wouldn't be something from the very beginning as you're arguing here today.
I don't believe that the cross-examination raised an allegation that the child was being fed lines by the Children's Advocacy Center. I believe that counsel was merely trying to clarify the source of that particular word choice. And if we are going to so limit, I believe there are due process concerns with so strictly limiting cross-examination of the complaining witness in a case where only the complaining witness's testimony is necessary to secure conviction.
It doesn't limit the cross-examination. It simply allows the state to move forward with evidence of a prior consistent statement. That's not limiting the cross-examination, is it?
It forces defense counsel to make a choice between admission of evidence that goes much further than we would otherwise want it to in terms of admitting the forensic interview. The ancillary concern there is even if defense counsel did open the door to it, the decision in Hammonds still doesn't go far enough to allow admission of the forensic interview. The decision in Hammonds would allow the child to testify to similar statements made during the forensic interview, but it would not go so far as to allow the admission of the forensic interview. Yeah. Since Bayes found, the Court of Criminal Appeals found in Bayes that admission of the forensic interview was an abuse of discretion,
But the facts were different in that case. That wasn't in response to an argued recent fabrication. Correct?
Correct. But this court then in McGregor, a case in which Chief Justice Livingston and Justice Meyer, you wrote the opinion, then reached a similar conclusion. It was an unpublished opinion in McGregor v. State. Also found, in that case, the state stipulated that admission of the forensic interview, again, abuse of discretion. Appellant simply urges that the court continue along with the existing trend that admission of the forensic interview's error, and then we reach a question of harm. In McGregor, Justice Meyer, in Justice Meyer's opinion, the court found admission of the forensic interview to be harmless error, essentially that the testimony would have been otherwise allowed, or that the CW, the complaining witness, could have testified to the contents of the video. Therefore, the admission of the video was harmless. I spend a large chunk of my brief, a large portion of my brief, discussing various theories for how admission of the forensic interview causes harm to the appellant in this case. I focus a large portion of the harm argument on the absence of a contemporaneous cross-examination. The difference between admission of the forensic interview and having the complainant testify to those similar prior consistent statements is that there is no opportunity for contemporaneous cross-examination with the interview. If the witness is testifying to it on the stand, you have the benefit of contemporaneous cross-examination. If the video is admitted, you're depriving the defendant, the appellant, of the ability to contemporaneously cross-examine the witness. Without that ability to contemporaneously cross-examine the witness, the appellant is entitled to the contemporaneous cross-examination of the witness, not the admission of the prior statement.
Mr. Niehaus, I have a question for you on that theory. Certainly the value of cross-examination is beyond discussion. However, in the handling of a criminal case in the criminal justice system, this one spot in terms of the forensic interview of a child on a charges covered in this case, should that be morphed into the testimony of a police officer about an arrest on a question of a previous activity in terms of the building of a case on a DWI? I mean, there are many stages in the initiation, investigation, and then prosecution of a criminal charge where it's just simply not possible that counsel could be present because we don't even have a crime as yet, and we don't have a crime for which there's been an indictment or an information file. So I'm having trouble getting as far as you're going with when there has to be the opportunity for cross-examination in the prosecution of a criminal case.
Yes, just during the trial, but the issue there becomes during the investigation and preparation of the case, the officer will come to the stand and will testify to each of the individual steps in getting that far. The officer will testify to the probable cause to begin the investigation, to the contents of the investigation, and to the outcome of the investigation leading to the defendant's arrest and subsequent prosecution. In this case, by allowing admission of the forensic interview, you're removing the need to have the complainant testify to the contents of that forensic interview, and thereby removing those, the ability to cross, you're restricting the ability to get into a full cross-examination of the facts as they relate to the statements that were made when they were made. And it's that contemporaneous cross-examination that Justice Scalia focused on so heavily in Davis v. Washington, that it's the contemporaneous cross-examination. It's not a delayed ability to cross-examine. It's cross-examination contemporaneous with the testimony that's being presented.
Would it be fair to characterize your argument on the basis of the question, on the question of harm in this case, as having a prior requirement for there being an inconsistency in the trial testimony as versus the extrinsic interview statement?
Yes.
So if there's not a inconsistency in the statement that was given at the start of the case, then there wouldn't be harm in what was allowed if it's consistent with the trial testimony, allowed to be showing the film, and the film doesn't conflict with the testimony given at trial, then there's not harm, is there?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So in this case, what was inconsistent?
In this case, it was the
use of the words, natural body response?
Essentially, yes.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. And that may not be enough to get us to harm in this case. Harm is, by its nature, a case-by-case entity.
I understand. Thank you for answering my question.
Yes.
Sir.
I'm going to jump over to Marin typing the 3837 Section 2A hearing very briefly. The court has not been presented an opportunity to address the question before. It appears to be one of first impression. We are arguing, we are submitting its type 2 error, error that is a right that is implemented unless expressly waived, as opposed to type 3 Marin right, which is implemented only upon request. Specifically, the difference between type 2 Marin rights and type 3 Marin rights, under my theory, as the case, as I am arguing the case, is that the type 2 rights are essentially those that are also contained in the Code of Criminal Procedure, similar to the the right to a trial by jury under Article 1.12, 1.13 is waivable. The right to presentation of an indictment under Article 1.141 is a waivable right. The appointment of an interpreter under Article 38.30 is a waivable right. I would assert that the legislature's choice to use the word must as opposed to the word shall shows the legislature's intent that the trial court has an obligation to conduct the hearing without regard to whether it was requested. If it is not a type 2 right, I see that my time's expired. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. All right. We will proceed with Ms. Simmons.
May it please the court, counsel. Andrea Simmons on behalf of the state. I would begin this morning in addressing appellant's first issue regarding the admission of the forensic interview. And the state does note that in most instances, it is error to admit a forensic interview of a child in a case like this regarding sexual allegations against the defendant. However, there are cases in which it becomes an exception to the hearsay rule, and such an exception applied in the case at hand, wherein the defense attorney questioned one of the two complainants in this case as to where she learned a phrase, a certain phrase of word, where she had gotten that, who had told it to her, and then followed up with questions also in his cross-examination as to whether or not she had made up a story. And he then followed through with that and wanting to know, had she made up a story? Did you rehearse your testimony? Who were you with? How long ago was that? And at that point of this, on direct examination or redirect, state then requested to admit the forensic interview of the child as a prior consistent statement, relying on Hammonds. The trial judge did in fact take a small recess to review Hammonds before making his opinion and decision, and then came back on the record to say, after having read Hammonds and based on his interpretation of defense counsel's questioning, that he found that he did in fact make an allegation or an insinuation of recent fabrication or improper motive or bias, and based on that allowed the admission of the forensic interview. The forensic interview in this case, therefore, the state would argue was properly admitted, and the trial judge did not abuse his discretion in making such a determination based on the questions asked by defense counsel or his interpretation of those questions, which is part of the standard of review, in addition to the tenor and tone of the questions propounded by defense counsel. Although the state does not believe that the issue should come down to a harm analysis, if in fact this court were to get that far, the state would argue that majority of what was said in the, all of the information contained in the interview was in fact cumulative of the complainant's testimony. In fact, her testimony was by far more detailed and included many more acts and allegations than her testimony in the interview. She actually testified in court to much more than what was contained in the interview, and thus she was, although not contemporaneously, cross-examined at the time of the forensic interview. There was cross-examination at the trial, and it was much more detailed than what was came out in the initial interview.
Was there any request to limit the video, in other words, to not admit the entirety of the video?
There was not. Counsel was silent as to anything other than objecting to the admission of the interview. It did not require that they select portions of the interview, merely to use that specific portion to prove the state's consistent statement, prior statement. And the state agrees that that is a possibility, I think, for defense at any time, too, and rather than opening the door to the entire thing, that there is an ability to limit that to specific portions that the state can rely on to prove the prior consistent statement. Moving on to the second issue raised by appellant.
Well, before you leave,
yes, Your Honor.
The issue of the forensic interview, do you intend to suggest to the court that in writing this opinion, if we were to take position that the forensic interview was properly admitted, would be carving an exception to the general rule that you do not allow the forensic interview to be admitted?
To the extent that it's considered an exception under 801 that turns the forensic interview or the inadmissible evidence into non-hearsay. And that I don't think that the court would be carving out any new exception rather than just following the Texas legislature language and their assertion of the exception that applies under 801.
All right, thank you.
If there are no other questions as to the forensic interview, I'll move on to the second point of error raised by appellant, which is the extraneous offenses, admission of extraneous offenses, and the lack of a hearing outside the presence of the jury. There were multiple instances which were complained of. State gave approximately, I believe it was somewhere between 42 and 48 notices, of which were complained of at trial and on appeal. The state would note, however, that at trial, the complaints lodged by defense counsel primarily were aimed at whether or not there was appropriate time frames and notices given as to when the offenses occurred, which of course the state would always address as this is a case involving young children where the on or about dates are sufficient given that we provide as many details as possible about the offense itself. And those objections therein have turned into objections or issues raised in the appeal as to whether or not a hearing was necessary to prove each of those acts beyond a reasonable doubt. And the state's argument, which I painstakingly went through each and every one of the issues, notices given by the state, and I would like to rely on my brief for each of those individually and not go through those, but many of those are gonna fall through. They're merely just instances that have do not constitute any type of criminal offense whatsoever. Were things that were not admitted at trial, were evidence of acts that substantiated the allegations for which appellant stood on trial, and also were acts and behaviors that showed the relationship between the appellant, who was the victim's stepfather, and that such evidence is allowed in the case to show that relationship to the jury. And so I did not go into a large Marin analysis because in my opinion I felt that because it did not fall within the ambits of appellant's argument, then the Marin analysis therefore was irrelevant. As to the defense of, if no one has any questions, briefly on appellant's defense argument of the testimony, that was prohibited by the witness of which he complains. State would just note that during the trial itself, they admitted that most of the testimony was inadmissible hearsay, and largely she was wanting to, the woman was wanting to testify to stuff that her husband had told her for which there was no exception to the hearsay rule to admit that testimony. She did, in fact, testify. It was just very brief because nothing was admissible. And so the state just does not see how they get around that argument of admissibility through the rules of evidence by getting that testimony in. If this court has no other questions, the state would just rely on its brief and ask that this court affirm the trial court's opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Niehaus.
Please, court, counsel. A quick point on the tenor and tone of the cross-examination. In the volume of the record where the state and defense counsel are discussing the cross-examination of the complainant, the state agrees with defense counsel that his cross-examination was of a much gentler and less adversarial demeanor than his usual performance. He played with kids, with kid gloves, with this child, and the admission of the forensic interview, even though he played with kid gloves with the complaint interview, even though he was playing with kid gloves, was improper. With regard to the Marin typing of the failure to hold a 3837 Section 2A hearing, I will freely admit that it would have been better had defense counsel actually requested the hearing. It is always the preferred place to be in that you have exhausted your pretrial procedural remedies, that you've taken every opportunity to review and to contest the evidence before you are in front of a panel of 12 jurors and the judge. Unfortunately, in this case, that's not what happened. We did not get a request for that 3837 Section 2A hearing. However, there did need to be a 3837 Section 2A hearing. The category, the 40-some-odd individual instances which the state noticed fall into a couple of broad categories, that which is illustrative to the relationship between the parties, between appellant and the stepdaughter, and those which arise to essentially extraneous offenses. Other allegations of touching that would or could have been prosecuted separately for other instances of indecency with a child. Because those extraneous offenses could have been prosecuted separately, they fall within the ambit of what is required for to be proven under 3837 Section 2A. If the court has no further questions, thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Niehaus. Thank you, Mr. Simmons. We appreciate your arguments today as well as your briefing in this matter. Your case has been submitted and you all are now excused. We will proceed back to our other case, Hoskins and Echol versus Rico Family Partners.